Well, we're very excited today. We're going to be having a conversation with Dr. Bruce Lipton. And Bruce was a stem cell or is a stem cell biologist. He's also the best-selling author of the books The Biology of Belief, Spontaneous Evolution, and The Honeymoon Effect. He's also the recipient of the 2009 GOI Peace Award, and he's been the guest speaker on hundreds of TV shows and radio shows, as well as the keynote presenter for national and international conferences. And I am very excited to be with him today and having this conversation. Welcome to the show, Bruce. Thank you so much.
I am so happy to be here with you, and I really want to thank you, and especially I want to thank your audience because it represents people that are looking to take back power over their lives, and this is what we need at this time as chaos is pervasive and everywhere. It's time for us to re-empower ourselves, so I appreciate this opportunity.
Well, thank you. We also see it as an opportunity, and I agree with you, and there needs to be some changes, and hopefully those hearing the show today, this will have an impact on their lives. I know it certainly had an impact on mine. To give our listeners a little bit of your background, Bruce received his PhD from the University of Virginia at Charlottesville, and that was before he joined the Department of Anatomy at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine in 1973. And along the way, Dr. Lipton began to do some research on muscular dystrophy, and he basically was trying to discover what was controlling cell behavior. And it was during this time that he began to notice something very strange happening in the cells, something he wasn't quite expecting. And Dr. Lipton produced these breakthrough studies on cell membrane, which revealed that the outer layer was the cell's equivalent of a brain, not the nucleus as before had been thought. His research at Stanford University School of Medicine between 1987 and 1992 revealed that the environment operating through the membrane controlled the behavior and physiology of the cell, turning the genes on and off. And today we're going to be speaking with Bruce about this and why this discovery is so important and what it actually means for us and our evolutionary processes as human beings and in our future. So, Bruce, this is a big topic, I know, for many. So if you can, when you're relaying some of this information, please keep it in terms that we can understand. But you're doing some research. I want to go back to right before this discovery. You're researching muscular dystrophy, and then you make this discovery about the cells, which basically change everything that you'd been previously taught and believed. And it ultimately changed your life, I guess you could say. So can you take
the better? Let's
yeah,
add that.
For the better. Absolutely. And many others who've read your books, it's changing their lives for the better as well. So can you take us back to that time and share a little bit about what was going on? What was the research you were doing? And then ultimately the profound discoveries that you made.
Thank you for that introduction. Now I hope I can fulfill it. The idea is this: back in the late 60s, early 70s, I was involved with culturing stem cells. And stem cells, everyone's aware of them today, but back in those days, in the ancient days, there were a handful of us in the entire world that even knew what a stem cell was. So I happened to be at the right place at the right time to jump into something brand new. And what are stem cells? Just to help people out, simply, is this stem cell is the equivalent of an embryonic cell. And your body, no matter what age you're at, will always have stem cells in them. And I say, okay, wait. Embryonic cells are called embryonic cells until the moment you're born. And the moment after you're born, that what was an embryonic cell the moment before you're born is now called a stem cell because you're no longer an embryo, you're born. So we changed the name, but I just want people to understand when I say stem cell, it's equivalent of an embryonic cell. It's a cell that can become anything in the body, muscle, bone, blood, brains, hair, anything. It's an embryonic cell.
Okay.
So you say, well, why should I have stem cells in my body? And then this interesting point comes up, and it says, our body is made out of about 50 trillion cells. This is an interesting sidebar right here.
Okay.
And that is this. The cells are the living entity. You, by biological, scientific, accurate definition, you represent a community of 50 trillion cells, the cells being the live entities, and you put them all together, 50 trillion cells, you make a human body. So I call my human body by the name of Bruce, but Bruce then represents officially, legally, a name for a community of 50 trillion cells. So this is really important. the cells are the building blocks, and they're the living entity. So I say, okay, what's relevant about this? I go, everyday normal life, whatever you are right now, you're losing hundreds, and that's with a plural, hundreds of billions, that's with a B, hundreds of billions of cells every day are dying, normal attrition. That's just normal rate. Your blood cells are dying by the millions. Your skin cells are dying. The entire lining of your digestive tract is replaced every 3 days. It's nearly a trillion cells. I go, well, what is the meaning of this? And it's very obvious at this moment. It says, look, you're made out of a community of 50 trillion cells. You're losing every day of life hundreds of billions of your cells, normal attrition. You want to stay alive? Oh, then you have to replace the cells that are dying every day. And I go, and who does that? And now we've returned full cycle. I say, that's why you have stem cells. These embryonic cells stay in your body because every day you have to replace hundreds of billions, and they are the source of the new cells. So I say, okay, stem cells are embryonic multipotential cells. Back in 1968, when I was really getting engaged in cloning a stem cell, this is what I would do. I would take one stem cell by itself and put it in a petri dish all alone. And the cell divides every 10 hours. So 10 hours after I put that cell in, now there are two cells. 10 hours later, the population doubles. Now it's four cells. 10 hours later, then it's eight cells. So I say, well, by the end of a week, I end up with about 50,000 cells in the petri dish. But here's the most important part of my work so far. All of the cells in that petri dish came from one parent. Point. I have 50,000 genetically identical cells. Okay, so that's the starting place for my experiment.
Okay.
And while I'm doing this experiment, what else am I doing? Well, I'm teaching. I'm teaching medical students. I say, well, what are you teaching medical students? I say, well, in my course, which is histology and cell biology, the foundation of life for medical students, we were teaching something called genetic determinism. That was the belief that the structure of your body is determined or controlled by your genes. But also at that point, they started to recognize, well, in addition, genes also influence behavior and emotions. So basically, the biology at that time in the 70s to 80s was a biology that says that your characteristics, physical, emotional behavior, are based on the genes that you've received. And I go, oh, okay, so the genes control all of this, and we're talking about genetic control, genetic determinism. Your life is determined. I say, well, what does it mean? Think about it. And I go, oh, my goodness, it means at the moment of conception, when you receive a set of genes from your mother and a set of genes from your father, if the genes are controlling the fate of you, then at that moment, there's almost like a blueprint for your life has just been laid out by the genes you receive. Oh,
right, kind of. Like you're victimized by it, almost.
Exactly. Like if your parents, your mother had cancer, and she had a so-called cancer gene, then you would think, oh, my goodness, I could be receiving that gene, and then my life will have cancer. And I go, well, here's the problem of teaching what was called genetic determinism or genetic control. And that is, as far as we know, we didn't pick the genes you came with. Part two, if you don't like the traits that the genes that you have are providing, you can't do anything about it either. And I say, wait a minute, what does that mean to the patient? What does it mean when I'm teaching this to a doctor who is going to talk to their patients? What is the doctor going to tell the patient? The answer is this. Your genes control your characteristics, and you don't control them, and therefore your fate is going to be determined in the genes. Now, all of a sudden, I says, if your life is controlled by genes and you can't control the genes, then by definition, you're a victim of your heredity. Meaning, what is being passed down in your family? Because guess what? If you got the genes, you're going to get it. That's what we taught. I said, well, what does that mean to a patient that walks into an office whose doctor has been trained this way, which almost all of them have? And this is what the patient realizes. Oh, my God, I'm a victim. I have no power over my genes. They have power over me. And when you give that information to a patient, you have disempowered the patient, saying, well, you can't do anything about it. You got the cancer gene. That's going to happen here. Mm-hmm. And when people feel disempowered, they also lose responsibility. Oh, why should I give a darn about this? If it's going to come down to cancer, then anything I do is not going to stop it. So who cares? And then people have a lack of responsibility about their lives because they feel that they are the victims of these genes which are more powerful. So we create victimization and say, what's the consequence besides being not responsible? Victimization also says this. Well, if you have a health issue, then you can't do anything about it. You have to find a professional because you've already been told these genes are your life and you can't control your genes, so maybe they can. And then the pharmaceutical industry steps in and says, we are here to save your life. And I go, oh, geez.
That reminds me, actually, it reminds me of religion as well. Like, you know, you're going to need to go through us to get to God. It's the same. You're going to need to come to us to heal yourself. Such an old paradigm, it seems.
You are precisely 100% correct in that interpretation, both religion and then later medicine. See, the civilization we're in now is called scientific materialism. And I say, what does that mean? I say, well, if you want to find out what's true about the world and everything you live in and knowledge of the world, you go to a scientist. And they say, well, it's scientifically valid or it's, you know, not scientific, it's not valid. And so truth comes from the science. In the previous civilization, which ended about 1870 or so, the church was running civilization. So if you want to get an answer about life or anything that was necessary, you go to the guy in the black coat, and you could ask the questions of life, and they were the truth providers. And then after 1870, science took over, and now if you want to find truth, you go to the guy in the white coat. But both of them, as you just said, disempowers the individual. The church disempowers them by saying, you cannot talk to God, but we can, and how much money do you have because we can set you up?
Right.
And then medicine comes in later and says, well, you can't take care of your health, but we can. How much money do you have so we can take care of you? And both of them have taken advantage of us because they have both claimed we have been victims, A, spiritually, or B, physically, genetically, and that we need them. And so the truth is, that's what we're operating with. I'm teaching the doctors that truth so they can tell their patients that they're victims. And then I go back into my lab and I say, well, so what are you doing here? I say, well, I have these genetically identical cells. I got 50,000 genetically identical cells after a week in this culture. And I say, what do? I split the cells up into three different petri dishes. So I have genetically identical cells in three dishes. I change the chemical composition of culture medium. That's what I grow cells in. And since I make culture medium in the lab, then I'm the guy who puts the chemistry in, and I can change the composition, the recipe. And I go, okay, what is culture medium? This is critical. We're going to come back to this in a minute or two.
Mm-hmm.
Culture medium is the environment in which cells live. It's liquid. Cells are like fish. They have to live in an aquarium. And so I grow them in this fluid called culture medium. I said, but what does culture medium represent? I go, it's the environment from where I took the cells. So if I get mouse cells and I want to grow them in an environment that's like a mouse, I look at mouse blood and I look at the composition and then I try to make synthetic blood, but now we call it culture medium. Synthetic blood culture medium is the environment that I put in the petri dish. So I say the culture medium is based on the composition of the blood. So growing mouse cells, I look at composition of mouse blood and try to make culture medium. Growing human cells, I look at the composition of human blood and make culture medium. So culture medium blood are the same, essentially. Okay, so here's the point. I end up genetically identical cells, three different petri dishes, change the chemistry of the culture medium, the environment, slightly in each of the dishes because I make the chemistry. And it turns out in one dish, the cells form muscle, and in a different environment with different chemistry, the same genetically identical cells form bone. And yet in a third environment with the same genetically identical cells, yet again, a different environment, the cells form fat. So I have three different petri dishes. In one dish, the cells form muscle. In another dish, they form bone. And in the third dish, they form fat cells. And I say, well, what controls the fate of the cells?
Yeah.
Well, the first thing is, hey, they were all genetically identical. First thing is, you can't say, oh, these cells had muscle genes and these cells had bone genes. No, they all had the same genes. So the only difference is the chemistry of the environment. And all of a sudden I say, wait a minute. I'm teaching in the classroom that genes turn on and off and genes control biology. That was conventional thinking. I go in the laboratory and it says, no, all the cells have the same genes. It was the environment that was switching the cells from muscle to bone to fat.
Yes.
So all of a sudden there's this great conflict. I'm teaching in the classroom, you're a victim of the genes. I walk into my laboratory and find out, no, the genes don't control it. It's the environment. And I say, well, what's the significance of that? And here we go.
Okay.
When I teach that genes control your life, I'm teaching victimization. As we said, you can't control the genes, they control you. But when I walk in the laboratory and find that the genes didn't control, this environment controlled it, all of a sudden I say, oh my God, what's different? Well, I'm the one that can change the environment. I don't have to have the same environment. So basically it says, I'm not a victim of the genes because the genes didn't make the decisions. The environment, in this case the blood chemistry, controlled the genetic activity. And since I can change my environment, then I am not restricted and a victim of the situation because I can change the environment, I can change the expression of the cells. And all of a sudden it says, oh my goodness, old science teaching in the classroom, you're a victim of your heredity. New science, you're a master of your biology because you're the one that can change the environment, and the environment is where the control comes from.
Yes, and this is, I think, just to speak to what you're saying is,
yes,
when you're talking about the environment, you're talking about taking this outside the petri dish. So then that would say, well, what controls our biology within our own environment? So if it's not the gene,
that
we normally do, please, yes, speak to that.
Yeah, and the answer is this. The simple conclusion of an experiment, genetics controlled by environmental signals. That's what it does. I say, okay, that's cells in a plastic petri dish. And I go, what does that have to do with you, a human? And I go, wait a minute. Go back to our very initial conversation, and we said, the human body is made out of 50 trillion cells under your skin. And I go, oh, well, then guess what? A human body is a skin-covered petri dish with 50 trillion cells inside. And I go, yes. And I said, is there a culture medium? I said, of course, the original culture medium, blood. So you're a skin-covered culture dish with blood as a culture medium. And I go, so what's the point? And this is what you're asking. And the answer is this. The cells are controlled by the environment. It doesn't make a difference if the cell is in the plastic petri dish or the skin-covered petri dish. The cell is controlled by the signals of the environment. In the plastic dish is my synthetic culture medium, but in your body, the culture medium, blood, is the composition of the blood, is controlling the fate of the cell. So it makes no difference to the cell which location it's in, because in either location, still the genetics are going to be controlled by the environment, and in the culture dish, culture medium, and in your body, blood. So I say the chemistry of your blood is controlling the fate of your cells. I go, yeah. And then I go, okay, now we're backing up. Now I say, well, then what or who controls the chemistry of the blood?
Right. I was just going to ask that. You're talking about, I just want to speak to environment for a second, because is it our inner or outer environment or both? Meaning, does the outer environment create our inner environment?
Yes.
So this goes beyond, and we're going to talk more about this too a little bit later about what we're putting in the body, et cetera, or what's influencing the blood. But I want to speak to the importance of the environment we live in or we work in or play in. Yes, please speak to that.
So we're left at the blood chemistry is controlled by the brain, which releases chemistry into the blood and regulates the chemistry of the blood. So that's the chemist. And then your question, which is now critical, is, so what chemistry should the brain put into the blood? And then I go, it's based on your response to the environment. And I go, well, what does that mean? I say, it's based on your interpretation of the world. I say, well, who does the interpretation? I go, the mind. The mind is reading the environment, and based on experiences, learning, and whatever it is, the mind will make an interpretation. Is this a good environment or a bad environment? It reads, okay? And then I say, yeah, but then the interpretation of the mind has to be sent to the cells for the simple reason this. Why do cells read the environment and adjust their behavior? And the answer is because environments are always changing, and for a cell to stay alive, it has to read the environment and interact with the environment, so it's always adjusting. The simplest one I can tell you right now, you walk outside of your house and it's cold out. The cold is picked up by the nervous system. The brain is interpreting it's cold. It wants to keep your body temperature at the right temperature. So when you feel cold by the nervous system releases chemistry that causes the body's metabolism to heat up. So as you walk out and it's cold, you can maintain the 98.6 degree temperature because now the chemistry of the body released by the brain is raising the temperature. I say, wait, same person walks out the door, but it's summertime and it's very hot. I go, oh, when the brain picks up that it's hot out, it releases different chemicals than when it was cold out. But these chemicals, when it's hot, what do? Cause the body to cool down, cause perspiration to occur, reduce the metabolic activity. So I'm saying, well, I'm adjusting my physiology. Who did it? I said, well, the brain was involved in adjusting. I said, yeah, but what determined what the brain was going to do? I said, oh, the environment. The environment determined how the body is going to go. So the control didn't come from the brain in a sense of making the decision. The brain just took the information from the environment and then adjusted the body accordingly. So the environment is picked up by the mind, and then the mind activates the brain to release the chemistry into the blood. The chemistry is the culture medium, goes to all the cells, and that regulates genetic activity. So to conclude this little part, just to put mind-body medicine has for years and years been, oh, that's a new age idea and all that. And I go, no, I am now telling you the exact connection. There is an exact connection between your interpretation of the environment, your response to the world, and your chemistry. And I'll give it to you right now, and I'll say this. Okay, you're sitting there right now with your eyes closed, and when you open your eyes, you see someone you love. And I say, what's the first thing the nervous system is going to do? It's going to interpret this. Oh, this is the person I love. I say, and what that mind interpretation leads to what chemistry by the brain, because the brain is going to make chemistry based on the perception. I say, oh, love, you release, the first thing you release is dopamine. Yeah. Dopamine goes into the blood, and what does that do? It gives you pleasure. So it activates the chemistry of pleasure. Why? Love is pleasure. Then I say, what else is released? Well, when you see your partner, you release also a chemical called oxytocin. I say, what does oxytocin do? Oh, it's the bonding chemical to make sure that you bond to the source where the pleasure is coming from. And I say, what else is released? I say, oh, when you're in love like that, you release another chemical by the brain, which is interpreting love, and this chemical called vasopressin, and that makes you more attractive so that you keep your partner's attentions. And then lastly, in this case, there's many of them, but I'll give one more, and I say, when you open your eyes and interpret love, mind sees love, the brain is then going to release something called growth hormone, which by definition you could growth hormone. I say, what is the consequence of the blood chemistry when you see someone you love? And I say, the elements, dopamine, vasopressin, oxytocin, growth hormone, if you add them to a regular petri dish, the cells grow exuberantly well. The cells grow very healthy. And I go, no kidding. When people fall in love, you can see they're healthy because
that is so true.
They glow. And I go, this is not a coincidence. This is a chemistry. It's a chemistry of an interpretation of love, releasing chemicals associated with love, which encourage growth and health. And that's why people are healthy when they're in love. Chemistry of the culture medium.
Bruce, I want to take this moment right here. We're just going to take a quick pause, and we're going to come back. We're going to talk more about love, but we're also going to talk about the emotion of fear as well.
Yes.
Yes. And for those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to the interview. Today we are having a conversation with Dr. Bruce Lipton, a stem cell biologist, who's come up with some fascinating discoveries about how our thoughts are controlling our biology. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota. And we are back again. For those of you who are just joining us, we are having a conversation today with Dr. Bruce Lipton, cellular biologist, talking about how our thoughts are creating our world, our biology, our sickness, our health, etc. So thank you again, Dr. Lipton, for being here. Right before we went to the break, we were talking about the effects of love on our cellular environment. So why don't we go ahead and pick up there? You were saying that it causes the best amount or the highest amount of growth proteins or growth hormones in the cell?
Growth hormones, the signals from the brain. Everything that covers every aspect of your health is encouraged by a perception of the mind, love, which causes the brain to release the chemistry into the blood, which is the culture medium, which then informs the cells and controls their behavior and their genetics. So your picture in your mind is releasing those wonderful chemicals of love that give you all that health and glowy aspect of love. And I go, well, wait a second, just to compare how something could be quite different, all of a sudden I say, same person sitting there now opens her eyes, but instead of seeing something they love, they see something that scares them. I go, oh, that chemistry that was released by love is certainly not the chemistry now released by the brain, because in this condition of fear, the brain releases stress hormones such as cortisol, releases inflammatory agents that affect the immune system, getting ready for fight or flight and changing the behavior of the system. And I say, well, how'd you change the behavior of the system? I say, the chemicals of fear released by the brain go into the culture medium and they cause the cells to get into protection rather than growth. And the significance of protection is walling yourself off from the outside to protect yourself. Growth is opening yourself to the outside. If you want to grow, you have to take stuff in. You want to protect yourself, you want to wall things out. I go, oh, guess what? If I have a picture of love in my mind, the chemistry opens my biology to growth and enhancement and taking care of health. But if the same mind all of a sudden holds a picture of fear, well, the chemistry is completely different. It shuts down growth, and it shuts down the immune system. As it puts you in a get-ready-to-run, fight-or-flight, it's a completely different behavior. I say, what's controlling the genetics and the behavior of the cells? I say, the chemistry in the blood. And I say, the chemistry is related to the picture in your mind. And all of a sudden, I say, oh, my God, what was the point? And the point was this. We had held a belief that genes control the character of our lives. Now the new belief is, no, the chemistry of the environment controls the character of the genes. If you change your perception of life, you change the chemistry that you're feeding the cells with. But this is the chemistry that adjusts behavior and genetics. So all of a sudden, it's like the mind-body connection is absolutely real and physical in this nature, is that a mind causes specific chemicals to be released based on what's in the mind. And I say, why is it relevant? Because I can change my mind. I don't have to have the same thoughts. Instead of being in fear, I can consciously say, no, I want to be in love. I'm in love now. I say, well, what's the difference? I say, when you do that, you're the one that is now controlling your genetics and your behavior, because you decide the image that you want to send. But if you're programmed in some way, then you'll just follow the program and it will replay the same program over and over again. And we found that all of us have been programmed. Yeah. And that occurs in the first 7 years of our lives. And in fact, this is nothing new. I mean, biologically, it's much newer information, but I can go back 400 years and say, 400 years ago, the Jesuits said, give me a child until it's seven, and I will show you the man.
Right.
So what does that mean? What are they telling you at this moment? And the answer is clear. It's the first 7 years of your life where you acquire programs that essentially run your biology. And that's why they said, if you give me the first 7 years to create the program, those programs are going to be determining the character of your life as an adult. So give me a child for 7 years and I will show you the man means I can program you and determine your life's outcome by what happens in the first 7 years.
Well, let's talk about that just a little bit. Let's talk about perception, because, I know that I've heard you say before and I've read in your books that what we perceive in our own experience is actually more powerful than the world or the real world that we think we live in. And so
Absolutely. This
is our beliefs, if you will, that are creating the perceptions that then we take into our cellular structure, and it changes us. It changes us in a variety of ways. And I just want to reiterate to our listeners who might just be joining in, this is not pseudoscience. This is real science, and it's a new science that's coming out. Sometimes there's a bit of a delay between the lab and the textbooks, I would say.
15 to 20 years as a fact of science. That's the delay period.
So hopefully at some point in the future, this will be stuff that is taught in universities as well as basic school.
It's just the beginning, because it was established. Well, I saw the science back in 1970.
Wow.
It didn't become an official branch of science until 1990. And in 1990, the new science came out. I said, what's the new science? I said, well, the old science was genetics. I said, what's the new science? It's called epigenetics. It goes, sounds pretty much the same. I go, no, it's the revolution you've been talking about, Darlene. It's the whole revolution. I say, what's the difference? When I say genetic control, which is what everybody has been programmed to believe, That means genes control. Your life is controlled by your genes. You've got a cancer gene, you're going to get cancer. You've got an Alzheimer's gene, you're going to get Alzheimer's. So all of a sudden, the genes are controlling your life. So genetic control. I say, what's the new science? It's called epigenetics. I say, well, it sounds like the same thing. I say, well, when I say epigenetic control, it's a revolutionary difference. I say, well, what's different? I go, epi, the prefix epigenetics, epi means above. So if I say genetic control, I'm saying control by genes. If I say epigenetic control, this is a revolution because epigenetic control translates as control above the genes. And all of a sudden it's like, well, wait, we gave the control to the genes for the last 50 or more years, actually since 1944. We said genes control everything. And then in the last number of years, it says, wait, like my research showed in 1970, the genes didn't control the fate of the cells. The environment controlled the fate of the cells. It's the environment above the genes that controls the genes. So epigenetics is the new science that doesn't say genes control. It says environment controls genes. And that's what I saw in the 70s. But in 1990, I said, well, what's relevant? Well, that's 20 years ago. And I go, what's and why is that relevant? Because this is why the word epigenetics is finally coming into the mainstream population, even though most people don't know what it means. What it means is the idea of genes determining your fate is out the window. It now is you determine your fate because you're the one that can control the environment. And most importantly, remember this, the cells have to adjust their biology to the environment. As the environment changes, the cells must make changes to stay alive. So I say, okay, I have a liver cell. It's deep inside my body. I live in the world out here, so my environment is on the outside of my skin. I say, but the liver cell has to adjust the biology to meet what's going on outside of my skin. So how does the liver cell inside know what the heck is going on outside? And the answer is, well, that's the nervous system. The nervous system has receptors that read the environmental information, and then the brain uses the environmental information and then sends the chemistry which adjusts the biology. So all of a sudden, why is this important? It's not just in humans, and it's not just the environment directly controlling the biology, because between the environment and the cells is the mind.
Yes.
And the mind does an interpretation. Problem? But if our interpretation is incorrect, then by definition, the signals that end up getting sent to the cell are not synchronized or coordinated with the environment because the mind did an interpretation of that environment and may get it wrong. And that's why I say, hey, two people standing in the exact same spot looking at the same environment will have two different images of what they see. I go, and they have two different images, but then if they have two different images, then they have two different consequences of chemistry. So two people looking at the exact same environment, just based on how they interpret that environment, release different chemistry, which then activates different genes and different behaviors.
And again, that's based on their belief system, the programs that they are more predisposed to, or the patterns that they're going to probably choose within. So the beliefs have a huge effect on that input.
The most important factor. And in fact, let me give you an example of just how powerful it is. If you hypnotize somebody and you tell them, I'm going to touch your arm with a burning cigarette. And in their hypnotic state, they perceive you're going to touch them with a burning cigarette, but they just touch you with their finger. Where they touch you, in many cases within about a minute or two, after the hypnotherapist touches the person with the finger, at the site they touch them, an entire blister will form as it got burned. Mm. I say, yeah, but it didn't get burned. I say, yeah, but the mind saw it got burned. Why? It was in hypnosis, and instead of seeing a finger, it perceived that it was getting burned by a cigarette, and what did it do? It made the exact response necessary for a burn, but what? There was no burn.
Right.
So I say, oh, then the blister wasn't real. It was just a consequence of a perception. It was a belief. And I
right.
go, yes, that's how powerful it is. And then I go back, hey, so this is not new. People have heard about the placebo effect for almost 100 years. I go, so what is the placebo effect? Well, I have an illness. A doctor tells me that this pill, this brand new special pill, greatest, latest thing from the pharmaceutical industry, it's so good that it's even colored purple. And it's funny because that was one of the ads. This is the purple pill. It's like, oh, that's important, purple. What was the point? The patient has a belief system.
The placebo
effect. The
belief
system is that this is the pill that's going to heal me. So they take the pill, they get better, and then later find out the pill was a sugar pill. Now, right. I say, what's the relevance of that? And the answer is this. Well, did the sugar pill heal the person? The answer is not the sugar. That didn't do anything. Then what healed the patient? And the answer was clear. It was the belief that the pill was going to heal me. The pill didn't do anything. So that's called placebo effect.
Right, and it just validates the fact that we have the ability within us to heal ourselves. And I want to move into some questions, because since you've discovered and we're talking about the fact that our environment, what we put in the environment, has a severe effect on the outcome of our environment as well, or our bodies or what have you, let's talk about then the world that we're living in. We've got complete influence from media. I always say, you know, they don't call them TV programs for nothing. And we've got the effects of the technology. So in addition to the input that's coming in from these programmed media sources, does the actual electric field also influence our cellular state? So I know that's a two-part question. If you can speak to that, about how this technology is affecting and influencing us, and how the media is programming us to stay in this state of fear, to stay in the state of no action, to stay in that state of illness. Can you speak to some of that?
I hope I can. I'd like to try right now and basically say, just extending the last one, just one more bit, because this will make an important part of the answer, and that is the placebo effect is the result of not the pill, but the positive belief that this is going to heal me, and with that positive thought, I heal myself. And then I say, well, we've emphasized placebo effect, and almost everybody says, yes, of course I know what that means, but I'm emphasizing is really a representation. Mind was controlling over anything else. What people don't recognize is this. Placebo is based on a positive input, a positive life thing going on, and it influences your life. And I say, what about a negative thought, a negative belief, a fear? And I go, it's equally powerful in controlling the biology as a positive belief, but it works in the opposite direction. A diagnosis that can scare you, like, oh, my God, you have terminal cancer. Even if the person didn't have cancer, being diagnosed and told they have cancer from a source that they believe in, and that's the important part. They believe the source is the source of truth. The doctor says you have cancer. The patient's body does not have cancer. I say, what has happened? The mind takes the picture of the cancer proposed by the doctor. That's the mind's picture. And what does it do? It releases chemistry to match the picture. So guess what? A picture of cancer can what? Cause cancer. A belief of I'm going to die can cause you to die. So what was the point? Well, it's called in the negative belief called nocebo, positive belief placebo, but collectively it says your belief, positive or negative, will control the outcome of your cells and express a positive or negative consequence based on the belief. And all of a sudden this was the biology is just taking the picture in your mind and converting it into chemistry to reproduce the picture in your body. Most of us, when we were young, played with something called paint by numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes with a picture, and it's all broken up into little pieces with numbers in them. And then the numbers reflect the number of the paint color. And so you take your paintbrush, and it says number 5, and that's that color, and you dip it in there. And then you go to the picture, and wherever number 5 is, you fill in that color. And when you complete all the color things, lo and behold, you have this beautiful picture. And I say, and this is important. The body is paint by numbers in reverse. It's as simple as I can say it. And I say, what does that mean? I say, first the picture comes in, paint by numbers. The picture is complete. It's in your mind. A healthy picture, a negative picture. I don't care what the picture is.
Mm-hmm.
What does the brain do? Takes the picture and breaks it down into numbers. But the numbers aren't paints. The numbers are neurochemicals. The neurochemicals paint that image in your body by controlling the genes and the behavior. So the image in your mind, a picture, it's translated into chemistry to turn your body into a replica of the picture. A negative picture turns the body into a diseased, unhealthy state. A positive picture can take a diseased state and completely make a healthy state. In other words, a person could have terminal cancer, and the doctor, you're going to die. And then all of a sudden they change their mind and they change the way they live and they get a new vision. Oh, well, if I'm going to die, then I'm going to go out and enjoy my life. changed their life completely. And then I say, what happens? Well, once they started to go out and enjoy their life, the chemistry of the brain and joy was totally different than the
right.
chemistry of the brain. And guess what? A remission occurs. Why? Because the chemistry from the brain is now health chemistry, and it will revert the cancer cells into healthy cells. How fast? Spontaneous remission, instantly. And that's how fast it works. The genes can change in just a few hours.
So,
we already know that.
Bruce, would conversely then, so cancer then would be actively produced by an individual's perception, rewriting the normal genes into the cancer
genes? I was going to say 100%, but that would be a lie.
Okay.
I have to say 90-plus percent of cancer is exactly that. It's a lifestyle that is creating disharmony. Harmony, things that you do in harmony, like love and living and peace and all that stuff, those lifestyles release chemistry that promotes harmony, which is health.
Yeah.
But if you live in fear, stress, anxiety, any of these issues, the chemistry that comes out is not harmony chemistry, it's disharmony chemistry. And that's why science has recognized that 90% or more of cancer has nothing to do with the genes and everything to do with the lifestyle. And yet, our medicine world only focuses on, hey, the genes cause cancer. And it's like, that's a bunch of BS, which means belief system.
Right.
That's the belief system that genes cause cancer. It turns out that's not true at all. And yet, people buy into the belief. Oh, my God, I got the cancer gene. Oh, my God, I'm going to get the cancer. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? And then you get somebody like Angelina Jolie who says, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to have a double mastectomy, and that way I won't have breast cancer because I have no breast. And it's like, oh, geez.
I know.
Why? Why is oh, geez? For me, is because the gene does not cause cancer. That's a fact of science. The breast cancer gene, BRCA1, which she has, is, yes, that's the breast cancer gene associated with breast cancer. I go, hey, stop. Why? 50% of the women with the breast cancer gene never have breast cancer. I say, you got to stop for a moment. I say, why? I say, question, does the breast cancer gene cause cancer? The answer is no. Why not? Because 50% of the women have the gene, they don't get the cancer. So you can't say the gene implies cancer. It's associated with cancer. There's actually two words that are so mixed up and then destroy the meaning. One of them is causation, and the other one is correlation.
Okay.
Causation means something has an effect, something causes something. Correlation means something's associated with it. A cancer gene does not cause cancer. A cancer gene is correlated with cancer, meaning having the gene doesn't mean you get cancer. And yet the belief system, genetic determinism, the one that the public is still endowed with, is the belief, oh, yeah, genes turn on and genes turn off. Let's just stop that one right there on the tracks for this reason. Everyone says a cancer gene turned on or a gene turned off, and that's how it got regulated. This is totally false. I want to yell. This is totally false.
Okay.
For this reason, a gene is a blueprint to make a building block of the body called protein. It's a blueprint. It's all it is. You read a gene, and the result of that reading is to manufacture a protein. And I go, why is it relevant? Because it is a blueprint. And I say, Darlene, you go in the architect's office, and she's working on a blueprint. You lean over her shoulder, and you casually ask the architect, you say, is your blueprint on or off? And she would look at you like, what are you crazy? It's a blueprint. Still on or off? I go, precisely. The belief that genes turn on and off is completely false. They have no, what we say scientifically, no self-actualization. Self-actualization means self-control. The genes control nothing. They are blueprints. It's the mind and the brain that selects the blueprints, and now more importantly, come back to your question about cancer, not only can the mind select which genes should be activated, now listen to this one, the mind can alter the reading of the blueprint so that one gene could provide for several thousand different kinds of proteins based on how the environment and the gene interact. And all the why is this relevant? Old belief. The gene is the problem. The gene causes this. You're always going to get this. I go, no, a gene can have 3,000 different actions based on how you respond to the environment. And all of a sudden it says, oh, my God, then cancer is not caused by a gene turning on and off. Nope, 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 not at all. Cancer, there are no cancer genes that do that. Cancer is associated with lifestyles. If you have a very negative lifestyle, you can engage this gene, and that will facilitate the cancer, but that's less than 10% of cancer. Most of it is just the negative lifestyle takes a normal, healthy gene, and one of the variations, I said it can make thousands of variations, in an abnormal, unhealthy environment, a variation of a healthy gene can cause cancer. What's the point? The cancer wasn't carried in the genes, it was carried in the lifestyle. That's why spontaneous remission becomes important. The person changes the lifestyle profoundly, and the cancer disappears.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, all these years we have turned people into victims. And
so
saying, no, you got the genes, you can't do anything about it, and it turns out, no, you have 100% power to control the genes. And I said, only about 1% of illness is scientifically demonstrated to actually be connected to bad genes. And so I say, well, then over 90% of illness on this planet has nothing to do with the genes, but everything to do with the lifestyle, and this is what we've just found out. The concept called stress, and this is negative stress versus positive stress. You say, well, positive stress? So let me just say what that means. Go out and play a sport. You know, football, baseball, basketball, track, running, I don't care what it is. A sport puts stress on the body, but it's not negative stress. It's a positive stress, meaning it's a stress causing the body to build more strength to deal with it. A negative stress is a stress that threatens you. It threatens your life or threatens where you want to go in your life, a stress that gets in the way of you and your destination. I say 90% is now the number that American Psychological Association has affixed to how much of today's illness is related to stress, and it's up to 90%.
Yeah.
I go, why is it relevant? Because people didn't come here with bodies to break down and get cancer and cardiovascular disease and diabetes and Alzheimer's. Only 1% of the people can say my life is affected by that. All the rest, I say, you got all these illnesses. Where do you think it came from? They say, well, the genes. I go, no. It came from the mind perceiving a stress, the brain converting the perception picture of stress into chemistry that reflects stress. And that chemistry, including stress hormones and inflammatory agents released by the brain, will then model the genetics and the behavior as a stress response instead of a healthy response, and a chronic stress response, and that's where the disease comes from. Not a stress just because a saber-toothed tiger is chasing you. Yeah, that's a hell of a stress, and you're going to be stressed. Right. But if you get away from that saber-toothed tiger, the stress is gone. In today's world, what has happened, and this is where the problem comes from, because in the old days, as I said, saber-toothed tiger days, stress was only a momentary event. If you survive the get away from that saber-toothed tiger, there is no more stress,
right.
And now you're back normal again. But I say in today's world, stress is 24/7, 365. This was not the design of the body to be in chronic stress. Chronic stress is the cause of up to 90% of illness on the planet, and we have blamed it continuously since Watson and Crick, 1953, DNA double helix.
Right.
Since that time, we have attributed all the illness to the genes, and it turns out, boy, we have focused on the wrong thing.
Yes, we have.
Yes.
And so essentially, what you're saying is we are the architects of our own lives. And
that is
just
the exact phrase. Let me just say why you just said that. This is the exact sentence in a recent paper by Steve Cole, an epigenetic scientist, UCLA Medical School, said exactly that. We are the architects of our own experience. He said the exact words you just said in a medical scientific journal. And he said that our subjective perception of the world overrides our objective reality. And it's like, well, that's a confusing sentence. Our subjective perceptions of the world override our objective reality. So what does that mean? Subjective perceptions are, the other word, belief.
Right.
So it says your belief overrides your objective reality. And I say, what's objective reality? The life that you have. And so two sentences. You are an architect of your own life experiences, and your belief is more powerful than your reality. You can live in a healthy, wonderful, supporting environment, but if your belief does not see it that way, then your biology will get sick, even in the healthiest of environments.
Which brings me back to the media question that I was kind of asking before. You know, we live in an environment where there's a lot of fear right now being propagated. We've got an educational system that appears to, I don't even know, that's a whole other topic. But
well,
again,
I'd love to talk with you for the 12 hours all about that.
I would too, because it's a necessary topic. But so I want to talk about two facets just because we're getting close to time, and I want to make sure that we discuss both. I want to know how you feel the media is affecting, or the environment that we are all living in right now, because it is affecting us. It's a lot of fear. And then what ideas do you have maybe for us to get out of this program? Because how do we convince an entire world, really, but in particular the nation that we live in, to unplug from this technology addiction? And so,
okay.
So first address that, and then I want to talk about the change. You know, we are on this cusp of change, and I really want to speak to that before we have to go.
Okay. Very quickly then, the media is what sends the pictures to our mind. If you buy into the media, you buy into the picture. If the picture says this is a scary world, then your biology is going to buy that perception. If you believe the media, it will, because that's your truth, then the perception of a scary world is the picture in your mind. And a scary world means you must get into protection, so you release all the stress hormones. So when I show you a scary picture on the news, you will sit there and you will release stress hormones, which will do what? And this is why stress is the leading cause of health problems on the planet. I'll tell you number one. Number one, stress means fight or flight. Get ready to run. I go, oh, when you get ready to run, then you're going to use the muscles and legs and arms of your body to protect yourself or to escape. And I go, what is the consequence of I need to run? The answer is this. The chemistry released by the brain in stress causes, this is a sentence out of a physiology book, causes the blood to be preferentially sent to the arms and legs. I say, well, what does that mean? Well, blood is a source of energy. So if I'm going to run, I want all the blood in my arms and legs. I go, well, sentence, blood is preferentially sent to the arms and legs. I go, where the heck was it before it was in the arms and legs? And it was preferentially in the viscera. I say, what's the function of the viscera? Growth. Maintenance of the body, taking care of the system, keeping everything in harmony, all the organs inside, lungs, filter the air, give us oxygen, digest it, blah, 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 blah. Viscera is growth.
So it's taken away, the blood is taken away from the healthy part of the body then and put into a fight or flight preparation.
Yeah, that means you went from growth to protection.
Okay.
Why is protection antagonistic to growth? The answer is because you shut down the function of the system to save energy. You shut down the growth to use the energy to run away. So you can't grow when you're in protection.
But how do we change this now? How do we?
Well, then you have to change your perception and the ideas you have to look at. But let me add one more thing, because there's actually two things to add why the problem we are in right now because of the media. One, so I stop growth, which immediately means I'm beginning to die. Why? Because I'm losing 100 billion cells every day, whether I'm growing or not. I'm going to lose them. Number two, to conserve energy, it shuts down the immune system. I said, why should it do that? And the answer is, well, if you've ever been sick, you realize how tired you got when you were sick, because the system uses so much energy. If you're running away from a saber-toothed tiger, I don't need the immune system right now, because if the tiger catches me, I don't care what the hell's going on inside. I'm going to be eaten anyway. So the stress hormones shut off growth. They shut off the immune system. Immediate consequence of that over a period of time is that you will get sick. And you will be infected, and you'll get all these things from stress. That's why it causes it. And then lastly, more importantly, stress causes us to stop using our conscious creative mind and start using our reflex reactive behavior mind, conscious versus subconscious. The moment we're under stress, we start to get sick and we become less intelligent. And this is where we are right now in the world with all the stresses that people are buying into. That results why in the high healthcare crisis that we're dealing with. How come so many people are sick? And the answer is, how much stress are they under? It's a direct proportional relationship. More stress, more sickness. Create this world. Who makes money? The doctors make money. And then I say, what else happens? You give up your power when you're in fear. And that's why Donald Trump is out there getting all the support. Why? Because everyone's afraid and they're in fear, and they want somebody who's not thinking that, well, how can this guy be really a president intellectually? They don't care. They want somebody who's got a big stick and go beat up the things that scare them. No thinking. And so we have to change the picture. And I go, well, if you change the picture, as you said, well, how are we going to change the world? Old hippie statement comes in here. Before you go out and clean up the world, first go clean up your own backyard. basically says, before we go out and march and protest, if you're not living in harmony, then you're not helping. You're either part of the solution or part of the problem. And if you're not living in health and harmony in your own yard, in your own house, then don't try and make health and harmony in the world. You don't even have it yourself. So the first step is to take back power. And to take back power is step outside of the system. I say, why do that? Because the system, as we talked about in the first two sentences when we got on the phone, the system is interested in control. And using fear, it controls you.
Yes.
And therefore, when you step into the system, you have lost personal power because you've given up control. You've given up your intelligence to even think because the fear has you hiding and gives power to the one who's got the big stick. And
yes.
This is like, oh, my God, we're in trouble. So the whole idea is this. Is fear real? And the answer, no, it's a media story. You know, they blow everything up. It's like, oh, my God, genes are responsible for the illness on our planet. It's like, well, you blew that up because genes are responsible for less than 1%. You have the public bought into the belief, so they believe they're the victims, and their sickness is just a natural consequence of being a victim. It's like, all of this is untrue. You are feeding the pharmaceutical industry. You are feeding an industry that advertises in the media that you're sick every 15 minutes and you need to buy a drug. And the reality is, you must understand you are a victim of this consciousness. And you want to be not a victim, then step outside of the consciousness.
Yes,
stop
because
buying into it.
We have the ability to change that. And I'm sorry, Bruce, but we really are getting close to time. Just reiterating that you're saying, you know, get out of the system and be the change you wish to see in the world, to quote Gandhi. And instead of trying to change the world, start with yourself.
Yes.
I would love at some point to have you back and talk a little bit more in depth with this, if that's ever a possibility, but also to talk about some of the steps that we can take to shift those belief systems and patterns.
Do I have a couple of quick minutes, 2 minutes? How many minutes?
You have about a minute and a half, but I did want to give...
Ready?
I wanted to give somebody the opportunity to locate your website, too, so just make
Very
sure you...
Very simple. Let's just do that, brucelipton.com. And on there is all the information we've been talking about under resources, a lot of information about changing beliefs, and that's the most important thing, because A, we come to the conclusion very simply, the life and the issues that we express are a direct reflection of our beliefs. A healthy person is living in healthy beliefs, and a sick person thinking they're genetically modified or something is living in an environment that they perceive as not healthy, and then they manifest that. I want to change the belief, and the idea is, well, there's two parts of the mind, and that's where we get messed up. Conscious mind is connected to your spirit. That's who you are. That's the mind with creative wishes and desires. That's the mind that gives you the honeymoon effect when you fall in love, and your whole life becomes heaven on earth when you fall in love. But I say, but 95% of our life is not controlled by the conscious mind. It's controlled by the subconscious, which is programmed, and it's programmed in the first 7 years of your life. This is the developmental period where your brain is downloading behavior, how to be part of a family and a community by observing the behaviors of your mother, your father, your siblings, and your community. Point. The fundamental beliefs in your subconscious mind, the programs of how to respond to life, didn't even come from you. They don't even answer your wishes and desires. They're other people's beliefs. Problem? Science has now found 95% of our life is coming from the programs in the subconscious, 5% from the conscious mind, which is you, wishes, and desires. To change this, you have to change the subconscious.
Yes.
And the problem is the subconscious and the conscious learn in different ways, and that's always been the problem. Conscious being creative can learn from listening to our conversation, can read a self-help book, go to a video, watch that, or just go, aha, and the conscious mind can change its belief. Subconscious mind is the habit mind. By definition, a habit mind does not want to change. Why? If you create a habit and it's a good habit, the last thing you wanted to do is just change on you. So
right.
Habit is resistant, subconscious resistant to change. But if you want to change it, you have to engage one of the three different ways. There's only three different ways right
well,
now.
Well, we're gonna have to send our listeners to your website to find that out, Bruce. I'm
oh,
so sorry.
Goodness,
we're out of time.
So
I would
sorry.
Go on all day. And I hope that we can do this again, truly.
I know we can.
So
you
much
just
more.
Talk to the office and we'll do it.
Yes, but I just want to stop here and say, Bruce, thank you so much for being here today and really changing this or sharing this life-changing information. It really is. And for reminding all of us to challenge our beliefs, watch our thoughts, and make sure that our environment is one of harmony. And we want to thank our listeners for tuning in. And until next time, may your inner view be well.